All right, we're continuing in the book of Genesis, and we made it all the way up to chapter 6. And chapter 6 is a very interesting chapter. I'm not going to do too much of a preface because we might as well just jump right in and get into the text. But we're now going to be entering into the story of Noah and the story of the flood. As you may or may not know, and we'll go into this in greater detail, but pretty much every culture across the face of the earth has a tradition of a flood, a devastating flood that wipes out, you know, all living creatures and things like that. So from the world's point of view, they say that Christian story is, or the story in the Bible, which would be a Jewish and Christian story, is just another one of those stories. We look at it and say, no, this is the story, and all the rest of them are corroborating, you know, what we see in the scriptures. But we're going to find that the world before the flood is a pretty strange place. Why do we care? Well, it's in God's word, right? It's good to know. But this isn't just history for us. Jesus, when he was speaking on his Olivet Discourse, they asked him when he would return. And one of the things that he said is that on his return, it would be as in the days of Noah. So I believe that in some way, the earth that he's going to return to has some similarities to the earth that was judged. Remember, when he comes the second time, it's the end, the tribulation period, right? The end of God's judgment in there. So the earth is in that position again, where it's ripe for judgment. And it's going to be a very strange place. If you read through the book of Revelations, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff that's going on during that time. Not just the appearance of the Antichrist, but all the other things happening on the earth at that time. And so we're going to get some ideas of what the earth may be like as we approach that time. And I think it's pretty interesting as we consider some of these things that I believe that we can see maybe more than glimmers now in our own society that's preparing us for that, or that is shading us more toward how things were in the time for the flood before Noah was here. So without further ado, let's begin to jump in to Genesis chapter 6, verse 1. Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them. So generations are passing and people are multiplying. Remember, they're living extremely long lives, 900 years old, and they are fertile for long periods of time. So we would think today a big family is 4 or 5, some people 10. You know, here, my daughter came home and told me about a friend who she works with who have 11 children. And that's unusual now, really unusual now. It was more common, you know, 40 years ago or so. Well, could you imagine how many kids you would have if your ability to reproduce wasn't 20 years or 30 years, but, you know, hundreds of years, 300 years, 400 years? How many kids could be birthed in that time? When people try to do some of these multiplications, you know, if you ever, you know, did you ever hear that story? If you take a penny a day and double it over 30 days, how much money you have? Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're in the billions by the time there. It doesn't take long when you start doubling things up. The numbers grow rapidly. If people have done estimates and they said, well, you know, if everybody had so many kids and they had so many kids and so on and so on, some people estimate that the population of the earth pre-flood could be as high as 6 or 7 billion people, billion with a B. Some people think like there's hundreds or thousands or millions, maybe, you know, depends on how you want to do the math. There's a lot of people now. The earth is very well inhabited. So men are multiplying on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them. Well, that makes sense. Probably about half of the births, right? I think actually women tend to be what, like 50.4% of the births or something like that, just slightly higher percentage than men. That the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men, were of old, men of renown. All right, what are we talking about? There's two prevailing theories about this. So let's go first and just try to identify at least what's happening here, and then we can look at some of the theories and you can decide which one is more plausible. It says that the sons of God saw the daughters of men and they were beautiful. Well, that's nice. A lot of pride. And they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Now, the way this is phrased, the taking of the wife has in its inferences that they were taking them without consent, that there was something of violence in this, you know. Not that this is anywhere near accurate, but well, in cartoons and different things when they used to depict cavemen, you know, how did he go get his wife? He went out, knocked her on the head with a club and dragged her by her hair into the cave, right? Think about that. That's the idea kind of the taking here, right? So these sons of God taking these women and that they are giants that are being born in the earth in those days, and also afterwards. Don't miss those words. And afterwards, after the flood, right? In those days, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. So we have these sons of God marrying, creating children with these women. And we're having offspring that is abnormal in the sense that they are larger, giants, men of renown, you know. So if you go back and think about your Greek mythology, think about people like Hercules, think about people like was it Perseus. If you think about all the what they would call demigods, right? You know, Zeus in the stories there, Zeus would like these guys look down and he'd see a woman and he take her as a wife and have a kid, but since she was mortal and he was a god, you know, little g quotes around it, the offspring wasn't a god, but he wasn't mortal. He was hybrid in some way, right? Demigod, half man, half god. This is the idea that we're talking about. And these are saying these men of renown, if you want to go out from the Greek culture and think about other men of renown that we know in stories or his mythology, you know, think about something like, what is the name? Gilgamesh, right?
Oh.
Would be another one of those. There's also, I'm trying to think what the Old English and Norse comparison would be, but it'll come to me in a moment. But these stories of these great heroes, right, permeate the cultures around the world. So what's going on here? Who are these sons of God? It's pretty clear that the daughters of men is pretty, you know, it's regular women, right? But who are these sons of God? All right, here are the two theories. The first theory is a theory that came about in the couple centuries after, Christianity had begun. And it became popularized by Augustine. He's the one who probably gave it the most credibility. He said, they looked at this and they said, well, these sons of God must be the sons of Seth, which is a godly line, going into the daughters of Cain, which is an ungodly line. And therefore, their children are these giants, men of renown. That doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me. Cain was a man. He had daughters. Why would only his daughters be beautiful ones, you know? What was special about Seth? We know that there is no such thing as a godly line of men. As a matter of fact, if you trace the very line that the Messiah will come through, it's not a very godly line. We have all kinds of people in there. We have some good people, and we have some scoundrels in there, right? We have people that are not of Israel. Right? We have Ruth in there. We have Rahab in there, right? Not even of Israel. You know, people with all different types of reputations. So I don't get this whole idea of the godly line of Seth and the line of Cain. And why would two human people, if they were coming together, no matter whose children they were get together, have offspring that were radically different? Different enough where they would be calling giants and men of renown. And it was because they were coming together. So it doesn't really hold water to me in my mind. So the other theory goes back to really what was the original translation. If you read this, if you would read these verses in the Septuagint, which was the original Greek translation of the Old Testament, done by, I don't know, it was 140 Hebrew scholars way back in the times of antiquity, you know.
70, whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, X-axis means 70. So the legend 70, has it
Septuagint,
that-
70. Rabbinic.
The legend has it they all came with the exact same translation, which is not necessarily true.
Legend has it. So anyway, all these guys getting together, writing this thing in this Greek translation, when they translated sons of God, right? In the Septuagint, it's translated as angels, not sons of God, right? Yes.
In Job, the sons of God came together. That's right. And Satan came with them.
That's right.
So that's referring to angels.
Yep.
Sure. Yes.
In the song, in the other places, it's where we have very similar wording to this, sons of God. Job is one of them. It's in the Psalms, other places, always a direct reference to angels. And again, in the Septuagint, these Hebrew scholars who were translating from their Hebrew, which they knew very well, into Greek, which is incredibly precise as a language. If you want to do a study, sometimes it's very interesting. The two primary languages of the Bible are Hebrew and Greek. And they're both exceptional languages for clarity and for being able to have numbers, letters relating to numbers and all kinds of other interesting things. They thought putting food is a wonderful word to us in. But they translated this as sons of God, as angels. So now if we read it with the most direct translation, the idea, we say it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, that daughters were born to them, and that the angels saw the daughters of men, and that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they choose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in these days, and also afterwards, when the angels came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. So if we substitute angels, as they would have done in the Septuagint, that's how that would read. So now we have angels in some way procreating and producing progeny, children, with men, with women, right? This is the reason that whole idea of Seth's line and Cain line came to be, because it bothered a lot of people that angels, first of all, would engage in this behavior. And secondly, how could they? Because when we think of angels, we think of, right, ministering spirits. Yeah, Jack.
Well, we know that angels have taken human form.
Yes.
Because when Lot down here was the Lord, and then there were two angels, and they all sat down and ate. Mm-hmm. So we don't understand too much about this, but we do know that we can entertain angels unaware. So angels can take human form when given permission.
So one of the things that people use to kind of contradict the idea that this could be angels, right? I mean, it could be angels. It's got to mean something else. If they look at, again, the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus is speaking, if you want to turn to Matthew chapter 22, Jesus was asked a question by the Sadducees. They said, you know, we don't really understand this whole thing about the resurrection, right? And they said, you know, teacher, there were with us these seven brothers, and the first died, and after he had married, having no offspring, he left his wife to his brother, and likewise the second also, and the third, even to the seventh. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife of the seven will she be? For they all had her. And Jesus answered and said to them, you are mistaken, not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels of God in heaven. So people say, see here, there's angels. Angels, you know, don't get together. They don't marry. You know, they would be children. And they take this idea and they say, well, it can't be them. So it has to be something else. Therefore, they created this idea of Seth's line and the line of Cain. Well, if we look again at these verses, and you'll see something very similar, by the way, the same question and a very similar answer by Jesus in Luke chapter 20. You know, same idea there. It says, first of all, these neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels of God where? In heaven. The angels of God in heaven are the angels who were obedient to God.
Holy.
Right? We know that there is another whole set of angels. When Satan falls, right? Everybody remember how many of the angels rebelled with him?
One third.
How many is that? We don't know, you know, but I imagine that's a fair number, right? So we have angels who are disobedient. And that verse doesn't necessarily render it implausible that angels were up to some really interesting shenanigans here. We're going to talk about why in just a moment, but I want us to look at a few other verses and see if the Bible gives any other witnesses to itself about this idea that angels were coming in and procreating with women. Well, what does the law tell us that if you want to establish something, you have to have what? How many witnesses? Right? Two or more witnesses, right? So we should be able to find at least a couple scriptures in the Bible. Second Peter. Let's start with Jude first. And the angels who did not keep their proper domain, and I'm reading this from the New King James version. King James would say their habitation. Does anybody want to read this from King James? And the angels who did not keep their
first estate.
Okay. But left their own habitation, right? Is that what it says there, right? In New King James, left their own abode, same idea, has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day, as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, in a similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, have set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. So Jude is saying here, he brings this example up of the angels who did not keep their proper domain, right? But left their own abode or habitation, that they did not keep their place. And habitation, if you think about when we talk about our body, Paul will refer to it as a tent or as a house, or it can be referred to as an abode. So we have some idea that these angels some way left their habitation, the place that they should have occupied, right? Perhaps even was changed in some bodily way, right? That God judged them. He reserved them under everlasting chains until the judgment of the great day. Why? Well, he says it was like the same thing that was going on in Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, because they were giving themselves over to sexual immorality and had gone after strange flesh. Now, we know Sodom and Gomorrah, right, was known for its homosexuality, right? That wasn't the only problem in Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah had too much idle time and too much riches. And what is it? The idle hands are the workshop of the devil. Is that
the devil. Mm-hmm.
Puritan saying, right? A lot of truth in that saying. One of the problems we have in America, too, is sometimes people have way too much time on their hands, too much prosperity, and people get into trouble. That's a different topic for a different day. Sodom and Gomorrah had also this problem of homosexuality. We know that, and we'll read the story of Lot. When the angels come in there, right, the men of the city gather around, and what do they want from the, you know, those men there? They want to know them in a physical way. Going after strange flesh. Paul in the book of Romans will tell us that that homosexuality is against God's design, right? I believe if you look at the actual Greek, it's kind of like against the schematic, those there, right? And you can see that a man was created for the woman and the woman was created for the man in the ways that the biology was, right? But a man with a man, the parts don't line up, right? Woman with a woman, it's against the schematic, against the design. It's strange flesh. It's going against it. This is a problem that was in Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, how would that relate to the angels? Well, it would relate rather directly if in some way angelic beings were then coming in contact and concert with human women and producing these hybrid angelic / human creatures, people. Okay. Let's look at 2 Peter. Second Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 6. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and deliver them into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. Peter is joining this fall of the angels to the judgment in Noah's day, and also to the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah, and we know the reasons for that. So he's kind of linking all this stuff up together again. He's not quite as specific as Jude is, but we can see that this kind of supports that idea that there was some bad behavior by the fallen angels here coming into these women. Well, why were they doing it? Well, the verse tells us that the women were beautiful and was probably an incentive, but I think there's something even more sinister here, and that we will get an idea of this as we read further down into the chapter. So, should we do this here? Let's talk about it now, and then we'll talk about it again when we get down to verse 9. What else are these angels doing here? What could be going on? Why would they want to create human hybrid offspring? Yes.
Well, because it would take a human to redeem mankind. And if you polluted the line of humankind, then the Messiah wouldn't be able to come. So it was one of Satan's many schemes to win the battle.
There's a very interesting thing that if you look in the scripture, and we know that whenever time God says what he wants to do, Satan tries to oppose, right? Unsuccessfully. But he perseveres, and you can go through the Bible and we can look at God's plan as it begins to unfold. So the first thing that's been told now in terms of prophetic about God's plan of redemption, where have we encountered it so far? Anybody remember?
Chapter 3,
right? Exactly. He said the seed of the woman, right, would be the one.
Sounds who was say.
His heel would get bruised. So Satan is thinking, okay, there's going to be somebody that's born of this, of mankind that is going to be the one that is my undoing. So how do I possibly counteract it? Right? Well, if I can loot mankind so honor man, it's something else, then maybe there is no seed of the woman. Okay. Is this definite doctrine? No. We're piecing things together here, but the pieces can line up pretty well, right? So I caution you to do your own study. Be very Berean. Now you can come up with your own conclusions. So it could be that there is a dual motivation here. There's just the lust and the perversity that these fallen angels, when you're no longer holy, you will get into all kinds of things, right? C.K. Chesterton, I think one of his great quotes was, when people stop believing in God, it's not that they believe in nothing, it's that they'll believe anything. Did I have the right representative?
G.K.
Close enough. All right.
It's a great quote, though.
Yeah. The quote is good. Okay. So.
G.K. Chesterton.
Anyway, that these angels would then are burning in lust, things that they should never even be getting down to, and acting in a fleshly manner. All right. The Lord says, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. A lot of times people try to interpret this as saying God was going to take those long lifespans and reduce them down to 120 years. That's not what this is referring to. When God is speaking this, the judgment and the flood is going to occur 120 years from the time when this is happening. Okay. So we've got giants on the earth in those days, these hybrid people are there, and some of them are big giants. Another one of the things that's very interesting as you study all the world cultures is pretty much everybody has stories of giants. American Indians, stories of giants. In Europe, stories of giants. All around the world, giants, giants, giants. And we've also unearthed lots of bones, very large people. The Bible even tells us about giants, talks about the Rephaim, Zamzumim, all the different tribes of the giants, the Anakim. As a matter of fact, we're introduced by name to several giants who are after the flood time, right? The most famous of them would be Goliath, right? How many know that Goliath had brothers? Do you know how many brothers?
I didn't.
Four brothers, right? Wow. Interesting, because when David went out to fight him, how many stones did he pick up? Five. Yeah, giant, and any of his brothers that were about to come along, he was prepared, right? when they go into the land and they begin invading after the time there, they encounter the giant in the land. You remember the spies went in and they said, "We've seen the sons of Anak there, Anak, the Anakim, and we're grasshoppers in their sight," right? Caleb and Joshua said, "Come on, we can go in and do it. God's with us." The rest of them said, "No way. It's too tough," right? Well, when they go in and they start to take the land, they conquer a land called Bashan. Does anybody remember that? Bashan? And there was a king in Bashan. Does anybody remember his name? Got a great giant name. This had a great giant name. King of Bashan. Give us the dimensions of his bed. 13 feet.
Whoa.
13 feet, right?
Wow.
So giants, they're there. There is this abnormality that seemed to come because of this satanic, angel-driven activity. It was rampant before the flood, but it wasn't contained just to it. We see some of it afterward as well. Okay. So they were men of renown. They were mighty men who were of old, men of renown. If you think about this as an actual occurrence happening, and then you look at all these stories like we talked about, the Greek mythology, everything else like that, a lot of those stories make a lot more sense, don't they? You know, one of the things that always amazed me about the Greek gods, their pantheon of gods, and the same Roman, because they shared different names with same gods, you know, one was Zeus, Roman called him Jupiter, right? Is you looked at these gods and the way that they behaved, and these gods were not very holy, were they? They were mean and angry, and they fought, and they, you know, had revelry, and, you know, there was the Bacchus, the god of wine, who was always having a drunken party going on, and all of these other things. They were incredibly powerful, but they were acting in wanton ways, you know, and then they have these kids that they're these demigods, and these are the heroes of the earth. Well, if you had angels running around, they would have amazingly high capabilities. If they were fallen angels, they would be acting in wanton ways. It kind of lines up with those stories. They seem like not just creative myths, but maybe there was some remembered history, you know, that made its way through in the consciousness of mankind after the flood that these stories were then based on. Again, this is not gospel in the sense that, you know, I'm teaching doctrine here, but it's interesting, and these pieces kind of fit together with what we see in the world. So the Lord saw that the, yes.
You know, you're talking about at the end time of December. We know, I don't know exactly when, maybe you would help me with this, but somewhere, perhaps a mid-trib, Michael defeats Satan and all of his angels come to earth. The cast out of heaven to earth. Is that somewhere during the tribulation period?
Satan has come down to the earth with great wrath. He's cast out. They have a battle in the heavens, right. Michael and his angels against the Satan.
Then you see the angels walking. I don't know how they're going to come down. I mean, I don't know about that. They're going to be here, all of them, you know. So then you would say, well, that could be a little bit like pre-flood, couldn't it? You know, I mean, that could line up.
So, there's lots of things. And I mentioned to you, you know, our world today, where we're heading. Right. There's a lot of ideas that people are pursuing right now to create enhanced human beings. And when we're talking about enhanced human beings, there's two lines of research that are being pursued. One is animal human, hybrid kind of things. Right. And the other one is human technology. And it's blurring the lines of what is human again, right? Not taking it from the purest sense. And this is not fiction. It's not in reality today where we're seeing all these things, but it is being pursued and thought about. And the blurring of the ideas of what it means to be human, but also what gender means. We can see some of those, you know, those seeds have been more than laid now. And also, if you understand the idea of the metaverse, is anybody familiar with the metaverse, right? Yeah. This is the brainchild or the vision of Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook. Okay. He wants to create basically an alternate reality that is in the computer where you can interact and you would have yourself portrayed there as whatever icon you took on yourself, basically like walking around in the video game, but be able to have meetings there, transact, meet people, do all kinds of stuff, basically a whole virtual world that runs alongside of the real world. He's spending billions and billions of dollars. Well, when you, as a person, go into this metaverse, you can morph yourself into whatever you choose to be, right? You're not confined to your body, so you can be a man, you want to be a woman, you can be a doll. I mean, you know, who knows what you could be. Okay, it's all of these ideas of blurring what humanity is. Mm-hmm. Now, these are not a direct correlation to what it may be when Lord returns. But if it's as in the days of Noah and all these things were going on, there's a lot of little similarities that are going on. So if this is happening in our day today and happening very, very fast, how far are we away? I don't know. So it's important that we understand this because it talks about our future. It's also important that we understand this because if this was what was indeed happening, pollution of the human line, right, in an attempt to thwart the work of God and the arrival of the Savior, there's a lot of other things that start to deal with in prophecy and also in the conquest of the land that make a lot more sense. Because if and I hope I'm not jumping around too much. Is everybody, are there questions we're keeping? We're okay?
All right.
When they go into the land, Joshua is told not to make any treaties with the people there, right? And in certain instances, he's told to go in and kill everybody. Men, women, children, animals, everybody. And when you read that, you think that's harsh, you know? And why would God want to wipe out the entire race of people? Well, again, maybe, perhaps, we said that this kind of pollution, this kind of stuff was going on before the flood, and it says, and afterwards, we knew that there were giants in the land there. There could have been people groups that were in there in the Canaan that were polluted this way, genetically, right? That, again, is part of Satan's plan to thwart the Messiah coming out of Israel. He knows it's not just seed of any woman. He now knows by that point it's Israel. He doesn't know which tribe yet, or you know, who's gonna carry it. And you see, well, why would Satan put those giants back in that land, right? Why that specific land? Well, God said, this is where Israel's gonna be. So he starts seeding it with giants to try to keep Israel out and to pollute the line with them coming in. And God going in then empowers them to conquer and also then get rid of some of these things that could be then impediments to the, you know, the line of the Messiah coming out. Again, this is all conjecture. But if you keep some of these things in mind, some of these other actions make more sense. Okay? Anybody have questions here? I know I'm throwing a lot of references. We've moved all around the Bible here. We're good? Everybody over there? Okay. All right. So let's continue on.
Angels procreating. I mean, like producing. To me, that's like, how do angels create? You know, that's... I mean, you probably can't answer that, although you're very good.
That's true.
To me, that's just boom. I mean, you've done a great, fantastic job of this, but I'm just like,
yes, if they left that spiritual body, took on more of a fleshly body.
Yeah, okay. But
Don't know.
They're creating new life.
Know,
though.
We know angels have done that.
Life, not yet.
The Bible teaches that they have taken human form, as you entertain angels on the ground. I mean, not like us.
It's not procreating. Oh, not just, to me, that's just.
That could have been leaving their original state. But actually, they did sin, and they sinned by not keeping their normal form.
Again, we're not told the hows.
Yeah.
Right? But think about just where we are now. We understand the human gene. We can clone.
Yeah.
We can put different things together. We are also starting to mess with the human genome by changing it genetically. As a matter of fact, anybody here had the COVID vaccine?
Nope.
Right? Based on, right? mRNA, right? It's going in there and it's going into the cell and it's telling it to produce these certain proteins, right? It's using the genetics of your own body. We are starting to work with this technology. Well, angels are not dumb. No. Angels may understand genetics.
Oh,
you know, if we can clone, what would they do, right? Yeah, don't know. God didn't tell us how, but looks like there's some real shenanigans. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thought of his heart was only evil, was on evil continue, only evil continue. What a sad state.
Saddest verse in scripture.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, we're talking a lot about the angels here, but man is completely complicit in this as well. You know, it says that they were, that the wickedness was great in the earth, every intent, every desire, everything that, you know, that basis, the motivation, thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth and he was grieved in his heart. Now, King James, does it say repented in that verse there?
It says,
right. This is one of those places where I think that the New King James has a better feed on the translation here. We know that God is not a man that he should repent, right? Okay. He doesn't change his mind. God knows exactly what's happened, but God has emotions. He has feelings, and he sees this. Even though he knew it was going to happen, it grieved his heart. He saw this beautiful creation. Remember what he said after he created it? And it was very good. And here it is. And it just grieved his heart to see what he had made with such beauty, such virtue, now acting in a way that was so vile. Go ahead, Donna, you had something to say?
Just that it does not take him by surprise is what you're saying, of course. Yeah.
So he was sorry that he had made man on the earth. He was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and the birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. This is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God, and Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay. God is sorry that he made, but Noah found grace. Noah found grace. Man, since the fall, always grieves the heart of God. It is impossible to please God in the flesh. We can only please him in the spirit. It's only the regenerated man please God. In our flesh, we can't do it. We are 100% dependent on his intervention for salvation. We require grace. There is no way for us to work ourselves back into God's favor. And Noah found grace. And each one of us found grace. This is the genealogy of Noah. They're giving us a little bit of his family history. But it's more than just that. They said he was a just man. And he was perfect in his generations. Perfect in his generations. It does not mean that he was perfect in his behavior. Perfect in all his actions. It says perfect in his generations. It's a unique description that we get to Noah, about Noah, when he says that he was a perfect in his generations. It's not said about anybody else in the Bible. Perfect in his generations could be translated. The word generations in the Greek is the same word that we go back to the idea of genetics. Okay, it's the same roots that we use for the for those words, genealogy, genetics. It's all in there. So you could translate this: Noah was pure in his genetic profile. Right? He was a just man, pure in his genetic profile. If since those words line up, again, it gives us some of this, you know, plausibility for the crazy stuff that we were talking about in the beginning of the chapter. So if he's perfect in his generations, his genetic thing, him and his wife, then his sons and daughters also share that same unpolluted genetic line. And we're introduced to his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. I'd have a hard time naming any kid of mine Ham. I'm sure it was, yeah. In our English, it doesn't translate as well, does it? Okay. The earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. If the intent of the heart is on evil continually, one of the fruits of that is going to be violence. Why are people violent? Right? Because we want to take. We want to take from somebody else, and if they don't want to give, violence is the method by which we extract what we want from somebody else, right? What is the old motto or creed of Teddy Roosevelt when he was putting out his doctrine? Speak softly and carry what? A big stick. The idea was you don't have to talk loud. If you put the big stick, right, people are going to pay attention, because if they don't, down comes the stick. Violence. It's an expression of earthly power. So we see if your heart is evil, there's not giving it your own. It's taking. It's selfishness, not selflessness. And that always leads to violence. One of the things that makes the doctrine of Jesus so unique, and the gospel message and the heart of our God so wonderful, is that he is the opposite of selfish. He's selfless. When he describes what love is in 1 Corinthians 13, he said, love seeks not its own, right? Mm-hmm. Love does not look for what it can get, rather it's what it can give. And that's what God does. Therefore, his heart is not on evil continually only, but on good. And therefore, even though God exercises power, it's not in the way that man does, for using violence for selfish gain. When God allows judgment to come, it is, it's just and it's righteous. Very different than how we love. So God looked upon the earth, verse 12, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. What happened? They corrupted themselves. They were still making choices. They were free will agents, right? God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Can you imagine getting this message from God? And now he tasks Noah, make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. I was listening to a teaching on this by Chuck Missler, right? He really loves this. He gets into all kinds of depth. If you go on YouTube, you can find an hour and a half study just on the first beginning of chapter 6 here, if you really want to get into some detail. He's very good. Anyway, he made an interesting point here. He said, when you're building a boat and you're going to pitch it, he says, where do you put pitch? He says, right? It's a watertight seal. You put it on the outside of the boat. This boat was pitched on the inside and the outside. He says, why was it pitched on the inside? He said, my theory is that God wanted it not just watertight, but he wanted to preserve it. And he wanted to preserve it because he may not be finished with it yet. The ark may make an appearance some other time in human history as another testimony to what the judgment of God and what may come. Is he right? I don't know, but it's interesting. pitch, you know, using like an asphalt, that kind of material to seal it. This is how you shall make it. Now he's going to give him the description. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits. How big's a cubit? We don't exactly know. Right? A lot of people say, you know, the best guess, well, not best guess, one of the most common guesses is 18 inches, about 18 inches. But we don't specifically know what a cubit is or was. But if you use it as a foot and a half, which makes the math much easier, 300 cubits would be 450 feet, and it's width 50 cubits, that would be 75 feet. So longer than a football field and a half in length, right? And a football field's 50 yards wide. Is it 50 across 100 and then 50? I'm not sure, right? Here you'd have 75 feet in here, so not quite as wide as a football field, a little narrower. And it height 30 cubits. Naval architects have not only reproduced it, but they have studied this shape. And it's an extremely seaworthy shape. Remember, when we think about a boat, you know, here, we tend to think about sailing ships, right, or things like that. That's not what the Ark was. The Ark was a barge. It was not meant to be steered, right? You know, it wasn't meant to be navigated around. It was just meant to float. And it did that incredibly well. You shall make a window for the ark. You shall finish it to a cubit from above and set the door of the ark in its side. And you shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. When it talks about this window, again, we tend to think of like a little hatch window. More the idea when people have looked at this is a gap around the entire outside. Kind of think of like nice air exchange for the ark. Lower, second, and third decks. And behold, I myself am bringing flood waters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh, which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. Who's bringing the flood? God, I myself. This God is a mean God, this Old Testament God. You know, I'm going to wipe everybody out. I've heard people say, you've heard it too, I don't like the God of the Old Testament. He's mean. Mm-hmm. I like the God of the New Testament. Jesus is warm and fuzzy. You know, this God is mean. We don't think critically sometimes about what we're saying when we make comments like this. You know, God says that these people are all going to die, right? But they fail to realize that God is responsible for the death of every person that's ever been born. God says there's an appointed time for man to be born. There's an appointed time for him to die. God chooses that all the time. For most of us, it's what we consider a normal lifespan. We're born in the 60, 70, 80, 90 years later. We die, whether it's from accident or disease or something like that. And we think that's natural. God's still deciding when the person dies and in the manner that they die. He's right now decided because he judges and his calendar operates not so much on the idea of days and dates and time. We would consider it seconds and minutes, but many times morally, he judges things and he knows when a person has reached the point where they have hardened their heart and they will. And God allows them to remain in that. Fixed in that position, he judges. He looked at the world now and he judged. He said, okay, times. And he does that individually for every person now. And he will intervene in human history once again and judge the entire earth. It won't be by water this time. Peter tells us that the next way that the whole world is going to be changed and destroyed will be by fire, right? The elements melting with a fervent heat, I believe it says. Interesting. To melt an element, you got to get pretty hot. All right. So anyway, it's going to have a door in it. It's got this window. It's got three decks. And God is bringing the floodwaters on the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life. But I will establish my covenant with you. And you shall go into the ark, you and your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark. Keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing on the earth, after it, its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. And you shall take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them. Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him. He did so. So God said, you're going to build this ark, this barge, and it's going to be here to keep you and your family alive, your son, their daughters, their family, right? So we have eight persons that are going to go into the ark. And also two of every living thing will come on there. Now, this will be modified as we read a little later on. God's going to bring extras of some creatures. Very important, because when they get off the ark, they make sacrifice. If you only had two, that would cause extinction. God wasn't doing that, right? So God plans ahead here, and he knows his numbers. How will they get all these animals? Do they have to trek all around the globe to try to find every species? It says no. God sends them to him. Now, Noah is going to be building this ark for a long time, right? We got a century of building going on. Could you imagine what it looks like where he's trying to create this massive, massive construction?
Okay.
And as they're building all this stuff, they're not only building the boat, but they are stockpiling food, grain, all these different things that they're going to need for all these animals. And every day, all these different animals are arriving on site, walking off. You know, I mean, think about this. That within this century of time, every species is wandering around Noah's front yard.
And the earth hasn't been separated yet, so it's one mass. Because Peleg, later on, you'll read about
when it was separated.
During his time, the earth was separated.
Yep.
Right? So right now, and the scientists say the same thing. It's all together, and now it's spread out. Well, God did it in one day.
And so, he also says about these animals here, and one of the questions always comes up is, now, could you fit all those animals on the island? All again, who work this stuff out, say, yeah, there's plenty of room to fit all the animals. Remember, you don't have to take adult-sized animals. You can take young animals just as well as you can take adults. So you can take little elephants. You don't need to have massive elephants. Well, people said, wait a minute, what about the dinosaurs? You're telling me you can fit a pair of brontosauruses on that boat?
It's like you didn't take me.
Well, here's an interesting thing. First of all, again, you can take small, young. But when you look at the eggs of dinosaurs, they are relatively the same size as ostrich eggs and some of the other eggs, a little bit larger, but they are not anywhere in the size range of what you would consider by the size of the animal. And one of the unique things about reptiles, because we look at this with crocodiles now, is as long as they live, they continue to grow. They don't hit a fixed height. If they live 80 years, they grow. And if they live another 20 years, they get bigger. The largest and largest crocodiles are bigger and bigger. Well, if the same thing held true for those other reptiles, and things had amazingly long, you could have things that start out small and over a century and 2 centuries and 3 centuries of growing get pretty large, all right? So some of the conceptions that we have about these animals in their full-grown size, we have to think again a little bit more clearly, think about, you know, smaller sizes, think about the growth rates that may have come in, and all of this then makes it workable. This is a really big job that he gives to Noah. And God calls us sometimes to really big jobs, impossible sounding jobs, jobs to the world that look idiotic when you do them and undertaking those things. But the plan of God, the foolishness of God, is more profound than the wisdom of man. And what we're going to see about Noah as we go through this is a man who was incredibly, incredibly obedient. and over a long period of time. And I'm sure he had his days when he was like, I'm tired, or did I get this right, or you sure, God, you know. But I think about what this man will accomplish. And it's staggering to me, you know, his obedience. Now, when we get back together again, I think I'm going to introduce another one of the videos from the Genesis series, because they talk about the flood. And I think it'll be very interesting us to look at things in detail as we get into the next chapters. And then the geological evidence for the flood, and the idea of, do we see catastrophic changes in the earth that come at a certain time period? Does it show up in the geological record? I'll not tell you the answer until we get there, but I think you could probably guess. Okay, questions? So was tonight weird enough for you? All right.
Well, one of the things that I take great encouragement in it with a story like Noah, God could have just done this whole thing himself. He could have just wiped out everyone and started over fresh and anew, and yet instead he decided to invite Noah to join him in the work that he was doing. And Noah wasn't perfect by any means. He had the same sinful nature as any one of us, but yet God invited him to join in the work he's doing. And I take great encouragement in that he still continues to do that.
You had mentioned the term Nephilim. You won't see that, obviously, in the English translation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. An English word. But if you want, you can do a study even on that word, because there's some interesting connotations that you'll see then that may help unlock certain other prophecies when we get into Isaiah and some other things too. So understanding this is not just academic. I think that there is application as we go through the rest of the Bible for understanding. It's like in Genesis.
Robert, what word did you say?
Nephilim. Don't ask me to spell it.
N-E-P-H-I-L.
I have it in my Bible.
Got it?
No.
N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M. Mm-hmm. Roughly, that's how it's
Nephilim. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
The Greek word used there for maybe not Greek,
that's
maybe
English,
Hebrew.
It's just English Bible.
Or Hebrew word for giants or whatever. Yes.
It can be translated giants. Is also something with.
It's gigantic. It's a similar.
It's gigantic, but there's also about things with death and disease that are interesting. Other something things. I'm not prepared to give that, and I'll probably screw it up. I tell you something. So, shall we close?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Father, thank you that what you say comes to pass. It doesn't always happen as quickly as we want it to. And it doesn't happen sometimes in the way that we think it will. But what you say is exactly right. And Lord, you said that you were going to bring a flood and that there was going to be rain upon the earth, and it had never rained. It was a new thing. Mm. And for the people in the day, it sounded preposterous. It's like today, you say that there's rain upon the earth, that people still scoff today. They say, where is it? You know, people have been saying this for thousands of years.
Your word
is true. And I pray, just like Noah knew that there was a fixed day, we too know that there's a fixed day of judgment. And he was industrious. I pray that we are industrious, doing all that to do. Doing a different kind of ark, an ark that is centered in the person of Jesus Christ, so that whosoever will can come and be saved because of what Jesus did upon Calvary. So I pray for myself, my brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. that we would remember the days in which we live, and that we would be about your business. Continue, dear Lord, to fill us with your Spirit. Guide us, protect us, strengthen us, and give us, dear God, the ability to do all that you have asked us to do. In Jesus' name we pray.